Okay, Chair, I've got my devices rolling and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, welcome everyone to our to the meeting of the Delta Independent Science Board. And I'd like to call the meeting to order in accordance with the federal, state, and local guidelines to protect public health and safety in response to COVID. We're conducting this meeting entirely via remote access. We will take written those comments can be sent to the DISB at deltacouncil.ca.gov. We'll also be taking oral comments, and if you prefer to do an oral comment, use your raise hand function in Zoom or email your wishes and to the same email, DISB at deltacouncil.ca.gov. And if you want to give an oral public comment, we will please wait till you are prompted and then provide your full name and affiliation. Let me start with the roll call and ask the board members if they have any new declarations on conflicts of interest. Steve Brandt, no new declarations. Jay?
Jayla, no new declarations.
Jim?
Jim Cloran, no new declaration.
Virginia?
Virginia Dale, no new declarations.
Joe?
No new declarations.
Tanya?
Anya Heikula, no new declarations.
Tom?
Tom Holzer, no new declarations.
Diane?
Diane McKnight, no new declarations.
Bob?
Bob Nyman, no new declarations.
And Lisa?
Lisa Wager, no new declarations.
Okay, today's agenda is, I guess I'll talk about that later, but any public comments on item number one?
There are none.
Thank you. We'll move into item two, which is the chair's report. Just a couple of items. We the council, Jay and I, were going to initially make our presentation to the Delta Council at their February 25th meeting. We've decided to cancel that presentation and take it up on a later time. We were going to present on the invasive species review and present our results on that, but we thought it better to wait until that final review is available as a full report. We were also going to talk about our work plan for the year, and that is still evolving a little bit, so we thought it better to get that more firmly in hand before we have our meeting. We haven't, with the council, we haven't set a new council date yet for that particular item. The second item is that, as you know, we're trying to get a couple of Delta Independent Science Board postdoctoral scholars for the board to help us in our meeting our obligations. And so last week I sent a statement of work to the council and detailing what those scholars might do and how that system might be set up. And they are currently evaluating that submission, and we'll be working back and forth till we have something ready that's to go out for contract to get those positions. The next item is on behalf of the Delta ISB, Cheryl attended the second meeting of the Early Detection and Rapid Response Workshop of the Delta Interagency Invasive Species Coordination Team. I had attended that back in October, thought it was a useful thing for us to participate in given our reviews and given the amount of, given the effort that they're working on now, which relates a lot to some of the recommendations we have made. So Cheryl, did you want to report on that meeting?
Thanks, Steve. So the Early Detection and Rapid Response Working Group, it's drafted an Early Detection and Rapid Response, or EDRR, framework. Their meetings for the next couple months are focused on carving out details for the framework and preparing to communicate their work at the 2021 Bay Delta Science Conference in April. And feedback from the conference is going to be integrated into the finalized framework. During the January meeting, which I attended, the group discussed preparedness as a component of the framework, and they worked through relevant topics within the component, including prevention, horizon scanning, risk analysis, and funding, among other things. And then all of you can find more details about their discussion in an upcoming meeting summary that I will provide. I'm working on right now.
Thanks, Cheryl. Any questions? What we're trying to get in the practice of doing now is on a lot of these workshops and meetings that often board members would attend and report back to the board on, We're asking our program, science program staff to attend and do that for us, report back to us both verbally on things that might be relevant to us and also provide a little bit of a written summary. We've also done the same thing on the adaptive management forum that's going to be covered in the Delta Lead Scientist report. Our agenda today, just an overview, is quite full. We have a number of items on the agenda, in particular looking at our water supply reliability review and our science needs assessment, and then having a specific presentation on the Delta Adapts draft vulnerability assessment. I won't go into those details, but I ask folks to keep on time, and Edmund's going to try and keep us on time so we can try and finish on time because of the sort of a full agenda we have. So that's my report. Does anyone have any questions on that? Okay, any public comments, Edmund?
There are none, and we are on time.
Thanks. Okay, we're moving on to item number 3, which is a report by the Delta Stewardship Council, an executive officer report, and I believe Susan Tatayan is going to be giving that for us.
That is correct. Susan's currently on. So Susan, if you can turn on your, if you can present your update.
Okay, any public comments on that? Susan, can you, if you can hear us, you're currently mic'd, or I'm sorry, you're currently muted. There you are.
Hi, good morning. Sorry, I'm having some technical difficulties this morning. So I will be as quick as possible in my update. At the January Council meeting, the Council received a report on our 2020 annual report, and staff gave highlights of our work during 2020. Including the ecosystem amendment, the Delta Adapts effort, which you'll be hearing about today, and the science needs assessment workshops over the summer, the science action agenda update, the litigation that we won early in the year, validating the validity of the Delta plan and the council's authority. I just wanted to share with you, in addition to the update and overview of our 2020 work, there was a fair amount of exchange on Dr. Laurel Larson's spotlight article. And she, I can't speak to this the way that Laurel can, but a couple of the council members were very curious about what the recent article about phenotypes on spring run Chinook salmon might mean for our work and water operations in the Delta. So I thought that was excellent that council members got engaged about the spotlight article. And I'll stop there and take questions from you if you have any.
Yeah, would it be possible to get to send us a PDF or something of that paper?
I could do that. Yeah, I could do that. This was an article that came out in Science fairly recently, and I will follow up with a PDF of it.
Okay, thanks, Susan.
And I could also send my summary report for those of you who would prefer a high level summary of it.
Great, thanks. Any questions for Susan? Any public comments, Edmund?
There are none.
Chair, sorry to interrupt very briefly. If Mr. Brandt, would you be able to bring up your volume just a little bit, please?
talking to my computer, so I'm not exactly sure how I can bring my volume up. Does that sound better?
I guess if you got closer, it actually is a little bit better. You're just a little bit, your volume is just a bit less than everybody else's currently.
Okay, during the next presentation, I'll see if I can rig up a microphone.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay, I think we can move on to item number 4, which is an update on the Delta Adapts draft vulnerability assessment. It's my understanding this has been a sort of a 2-year effort that the council has undertaken to try and look at a sort of a vulnerability assessment of the Delta 2 climate change. And there is a 199-page report you were sent a connection to a couple of days ago. But, you know, I did breeze through that report, and it is something I would actually recommend for all of the board members to breeze through. And in particular, I know there's a lot of interest in sort of looking at reviewing the background of what's going on in the Delta, what the Delta is all about, what are some of the key fundamental issues. And it's a really good, in my view, really good summary of, with a lot of tables and figures, I want to say glossy tables and figures that really describe the Delta. And I think you could breeze through that fairly quickly and get a sense of some of the issues related to water, Delta as place, things like that, and it provides statistics and tables in a real readable format. So I encourage you to sort of flip through that, and there are some things in there that will really provide, I think, a good background in general for the Delta, and then in particular to things that might be affected by the climate change issues. We've asked them to come and present this because it is something we've been talking about a lot in all of our reviews, as well as some of the future thinking we're talking about. That draft assessment is out for public review now, and we as a board are not going to review it as a unit, but you're welcome to review it and provide your own public comment individually, which I think has a March 16th deadline. So we have, I want to thank our presenters today who will give us a brief update on what it's all about, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Our presenters today are Assistant Planning Director Harriet Ross, Supervising Engineer Andrew Schwartz, and Senior Environmental Scientist Dylan Chappell of the Delta Stewardship Council. Thank you very much for being here, and we really look forward to getting your summary.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Brandt and members of the ISB. Again, I'm Harriet Ross, Assistant Planning Director with the Council. Thank you for giving us the opportunity today to share our work on the Council's climate change study, which we're calling Delta Adapts. Next slide, please. Delta Adapts consists of both a vulnerability assessment and adaptation strategy. And as the Chair mentioned, we're in the middle of a 60-day public review period, ending on March 16th, and we welcome your comments. We'll be sharing some of those key findings of the vulnerability assessment with you today. The overarching goal of Delta Adapts is really to build climate resilience in the Delta. Next slide, please. And we have some 4 specific goals of the initiative, and that's really to inform future work at the Council, help the state prioritize future actions and investments, provide a toolkit of information for the local governments to use in their documents, and to serve as a framework to be built upon by the Council and others in the future. Next slide. Delta Adapts is a regional study. We cover a large area, the entire Delta and Sassoon Marsh, and it is a planning level study designed to inform policy. A lot of other climate assessments have been done by state agencies and individual cities and counties in the Delta, but these typically focus on assets those agencies own or analyze vulnerabilities based on a certain set of climate conditions. And Delta Adapts is different in that it covers a broad range of asset types and climate change conditions. And it's really designed to be complementary with all of those other individual efforts. Next slide. Over the course of the last couple of years, we've had an extensive engagement process We had ongoing collaboration with our agency partners at the state and federal level. We built off of existing models and data created by our partners. And we really worked hard to ensure the future flood studies are generally consistent. We had a series of stakeholder briefings. Last count was over 70 meetings where we met with stakeholders to ground truth our data and to verify our results. We also launched a significant effort to outreach to community-based organizations who helped us structure our engagement to reach vulnerable communities in the Delta. And we had our first public workshop last week that focused on the Stockton area that we partnered with those CBOs to put on. We also have a technical advisory committee, which consists of experts in the system and in climate change. And that committee includes folks from academic institutions, state and federal agencies, and from the private sector. The TAC provided input on our technical approach and analyses. And lastly, we also have a stakeholder work group, which consists of the local agencies, cities, counties, environmental groups, water districts, that really provided data and input on our assessment. Next slide, please. So the vulnerability assessment looks at long-term changes in climate conditions related to changes in temperature, precipitation, and hydrologic patterns, as well as sea level rise. And those long-term changes can cause acute events, and we've analyzed those hazards of flooding, extreme heat, drought, and wildfire. Next slide. And based on these climate stressors and hazards, we've identified numerous key findings for those asset types in the vulnerability assessment. And so we'll be really just focusing our presentation today on the findings related to flood, water supply, and ecosystems. Again, as Steve mentioned, the vulnerability assessment is 200 pages, and it obviously contains a lot more information and a lot more findings, but we'll be highlighting those key ones for you today. Next slide. Before we begin, I just wanted to tell you a little bit about the equity analysis we also performed. So for the first time, we identified the geographic areas of the Delta that contain the most socially vulnerable communities to the climate hazards we looked at. So we did this by creating a custom social vulnerability index that considers 14 different indicators. And block groups with a high concentration of these indicators were identified as the highest socially vulnerable communities. And we defined those as communities with really limited resources to prepare for and recover from climate change. And some of these indicators include linguistic isolation, percentage of car ownership, asthma rates, access to health insurance. Those are the types of indicators. And through that process and analysis, we've identified three specific areas in the Delta that's considered highest socially vulnerable. And that includes the Pittsburgh-Antioch area, and it's also shown in dark orange in the map here, northern part of West Sacramento, as well as the Stockton area and Stockton and surrounding communities. So with this information on social vulnerability, we can determine how climate change impacts these particular communities, and our intent is to direct adaptation efforts to these areas first. Next slide. And with that, I'm gonna go ahead and turn it over to Andrew to talk about the flood hazard analysis.
That's right, I gotta turn my mute off. Thanks, Harriet. So yeah, I will walk you through the flood hazard analysis and then also the water supply analysis that we've done. Talk a little bit about what we've done and then the key findings that we found from each of those analyses. So our flood hazard analysis covers the entire Delta area, but doesn't extend outside of the Delta. We looked at sea level rise, storm surge, tides, inflow from rivers, the effects of the climate change on those river flows getting more extreme and seeing higher peak flow inflows to the Delta. And we took a lot of time to really understand the possibility of high tide and storm surge co-occurring with high inflow events. And we even looked at how the storm, the peak storm season seems to consolidate under future projections in the core winter months. And so it becomes slightly more likely that those large storms would co-occur with our king tides in December and January and February. And so that can increase the likelihood of a very high water event. Our flooding analysis really just looks at overtopping of levees. We didn't get into other stability failures of levees below overtopping through the delta. And we look at a no action scenario, meaning levees, essentially, we assume stay in their current conditions. We don't improve them over time. We don't raise them over time, but they don't degrade over time either. And we'll be looking at those factors a little bit more in our adaptation stage. Next slide, please. So we looked at a number of different scenarios of flooding in the vulnerability assessment. We're focusing on these four for the most part. There are some additional scenarios that are walked out in the appendices, but these four scenarios look at probabilistic flooding throughout the Delta in 2030, 2050, and 2085. And what these do is we use a Monte Carlo approach to pair sea level rise, samplings of sea level rise with inflow events. And we do each of these scenarios has 2 million simulations of different inflows and sea level rise and tide and surge events co-occurring. So we can look at how those water levels play out throughout the Delta and then map the probability of water level events that would cause flooding. So just looking at one of these scenarios, let's take 2050, you can see that the range of sea level rise in this scenario is between 0.2 feet and almost 2 feet, and then distributed around that range. And that distribution comes from the COP et al. 2014 paper that is the basis for all sea level rise guidance in the state right now. And then our watershed hydrology comes from sampling a range of GCMs at the RCP 8.5 scenarios. It's the 10 GCMs that were chosen to be kind of best for California by the DWRCC tag. And we sample across those ranges for peak inflow events and then pair those all up and look at flooding. Next slide. So with those analyses, we can create these kind of probabilistic flood maps. So you can see kind of flood risk unfolding over time in this panel. The light blue color represents areas that would not be exposed to flooding even during a 200-year event or an event with a less than 0.5% chance of occurrence in any year. So you can see under current conditions, there are a few areas of the Delta that have kind of less than 200-year protection, as we would say. Most of those are in the Suisun Marsh, where we see the dark blue color. That represents areas that would be exposed to flooding under something like a 10-year event or less. So annual chance of occurrence of 10%. And then some areas of the South Delta that are kind of no areas of known flood deficiency. And then as we move out into the future, you can see by 2050 and 2085, quite a bit of flood risk spreading through the South and Central Delta. And the annual occurrence of that flood risk increasing to being quite frequent in the future. And so, again, this represents current levee conditions. And so with no additional height added to levees through the end of the century, you can imagine there would be quite a bit of flooding. So this kind of really represents the amount of work that needs to be done out there and the choices that we're going to have to make about land use and how we continue to manage and protect the Delta. Next slide. So one of the other key insights that we were able to gain from our modeling of the Delta is this map of area of strongest climate change influence throughout the Delta. So we've always known that certain areas of the Delta are more prone to flooding from the river system, and some areas are kind of more prone to flooding from the ocean boundary. But we haven't really known where that line really is. With the modeling that we've done here, we can really tease this out in pretty clear detail. So the areas in the red dots here in the north and south delta are are areas that are really influenced by the riverine system, and the green dots show the coming flooding really being driven by sea level rise. And this is really important when we move to adaptation, because these areas will have different adaptation strategies. They'll need different adaptation strategies. You can imagine that in the red dot areas, projects up in the upper watershed to increase storage or get water off the rivers during peak events can help reduce stages in those areas. Those projects aren't going to do a whole lot for the areas in green. Those areas are going to need either higher levees or some other strategy, because that water from the ocean is coming. And there's, you know, there isn't a reservoir that's going to contain it. Next slide. So we've kind of consolidated and presented all of this information. I think Dr. Brandt was kind of referring to some of these infographics in his presentation of how the vulnerability assessment kind of presents some of these results. So you can see in terms of flooding, we go from 2% of Delta population being exposed to flooding to 10% by mid-century and 20% by the end of the century. And then the social vulnerability population, the populations living in highly social vulnerable areas, as Harriet was talking about, that we're able to tease out with that index, really explode at an even faster clip. You can see 71,000 residents in highly socially vulnerable areas are at risk by the end of the century. The area goes up, of course, acres of agriculture, and then you see going from about $2.5 billion of exposed assets today to over $21 billion of exposed assets in 2085. So a huge explosion there, tenfold almost. Next slide, please. We also break out in these key asset areas that Harriet showed on her slide: recreation, people, places, and infrastructure. So you'll see infographics like this. This is just an example, one for infrastructure, where we walk out kind of the key assets that would be exposed to flooding under this one, under 2050 conditions, to the different climate stressors and hazards that that Harriet talked about. And so you can kind of, these are kind of quick graphics that help people understand what's really at risk out there. And then there are maps of these as well. Next slide. So with that, I will move over to the water supply analysis. And this analysis really built on some analysis that was conducted by DWR and the University of Massachusetts for DWR's climate change vulnerability assessment. And we worked very closely with the team at DWR to build on this and improve it. It uses a bottom-up approach to stress test the system. It's called decision scaling, pioneered by that group at University of Massachusetts. And it starts with a reconstructed 1,100-year record of stream flow that's reconstructed from tree rings to really explore the natural variability that underlies the entire system, independent of, you know, anthropogenic climate change. So we know that California is prone to these long dry periods and then wet periods and the whiplash back and forth. And so this 1,100-year record really gives us a background of what's really going on underneath the system, independent of climate change. On top of that, we added an analysis of precipitation variability. So DWR had previously looked at average change in precipitation, but we know from the recent literature that we should be more concerned about variability change in precipitation. And so we've looked at that closely. We added additional sea level rise to the analysis up to 2 feet. Now that's quite a bit less than what we looked at in the flood analysis, but because of the regulatory system and the operations and management of the system currently, that 2 foot level is kind of the edge of what we can look at now. Beyond 2 feet of sea level rise, we think major changes would be needed in the system that the models aren't able to capture right now, or at least the models that we had access to. Sensitivity analysis to each climate change stressor. So we looked at how the CHIT system responds to changes in sea level rise versus water supply or temperature precipitation change just independent of each other. So we can kind of understand which of those is driving which kinds of changes in the system. And we looked at a drought analysis to look at how much more severe and frequent future droughts might be. Next slide. So just some key findings from the water supply analysis. We're looking at combined impacts of change in sea level rise, air temperature, and precipitation, that delta exports would decrease by about 10% on average or in average year types, but by 20% in the driest year. So in the years that we need the water the most out of the delta, it's going to be least available. Delta exports fall below 4 million acre feet per year, which is kind of a base level of a really severe bad export year. Up in 25% of years by 2050, that's a doubling of the years below that rate that we see currently. And we lose storage of 1 million acre feet annually in our north of Delta reservoirs, just making us much more vulnerable to droughts, making our fish and our aquatic species in the rivers more vulnerable to dry conditions. We looked at that drought, and we looked at the drought of 2012 to 2016 in those conditions, and we see that by 2050, a drought with similar impacts would be about 5 to 7 times more likely to occur by mid-century. So if that drought was something like a 500-year event, it becomes something like a 100-year or even a 70-year event by mid-century. So some pretty scary conclusions coming out of the water supply analysis as well. With that, I will turn it over to Dylan, who managed the ecosystem side of the analysis.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. So I'm Dylan, and me and my colleague Annika Keeley were the technical co-leads for the ecosystem section here. So starting off, this is, you know, the same format of the overview slide that Andrew just presented. So this gives us a look into some of the 2050 projections of ecosystem impacts in the Delta. And at a high level, flooding due to sea level rise, increases in air temperature, more frequent droughts, and shorter rainy seasons will all impact the Delta's ecosystems, which, as you all know, are already extremely compromised. The historical decline of ecosystem health in the Delta is really key here for contextualizing our findings. Looking to the future, it's notable to mention that these results don't include planned restoration, and planned restoration really will be key places on the landscape where adapting to climate change will be possible from an ecosystem perspective. Next slide. So to analyze the impact of projected climate change on the Delta's ecosystems, we first divided the landscape into levied ecosystems and unlevied ecosystems, which include the tidal, fluvial, and floodplain areas in the system. The ecosystem spatial extent was mapped using the CDFW VegCamp dataset mapping products. We crosswalked those with categories from the San Francisco Estuary Institute's Delta Transformed report, resulting in 9 ecosystem types spread across these 2 categories. Next slide. So unlevied ecosystems with their direct connections to water required a different analysis approach than the levee overtopping results that Andrew presented. Here, I'll give an example of this using tidal wetlands, which have declined an estimated 99% from their historic extent and are a major target of restoration in both the Delta and Sassoon Marsh. As many of you know, tidal wetlands have the ability to accrete mineral and organic sediment, allowing them to keep pace with moderate rates of sea level rise. To account for this, we partnered with Kevin Buffington and Karen Thorne at the USGS to adapt the warmer wetland accretion model to explore the potential risk to freshwater and brackish tidal wetlands. Assuming a starting high marsh elevation based on the literature, we ran field calibrated regionally specific models for each wetland polygon across a range of sea level rise scenarios modeled across the DSM-2 water level network. Next slide. We determine risk to tidal wetlands in 2 ways. First, we looked at changes when the marsh surface elevation would fall below the local mean sea level, which is the transition between high marsh and low marsh. Substantial loss of function between those 2 ecosystem types. And second, we looked at complete drowning when the marsh surface elevation, according to the models, would fall below the mean lower low water cutoff and transition to mudflat. So this differs from the levy overtopping analysis, which really focused on these extreme events that lead to acute flooding. This is really looking more at chronic effects. Next slide. So this table shows our main scenarios for the Delta's current freshwater marshes and the current brackish marshes in Sassoon. The dark green color shows scenarios where high marsh is likely to persist, and the light green shows where models predict a transition to low marsh. Black shows where complete drowning of marshes is predicted. So as you can see here, if we see two feet of sea level rise by 2050, freshwater wetlands in the Delta may transition to low marsh, but brackish wetlands may be able to persist as high marsh. Under the 3.5 feet by 2085 scenarios, both marsh types are likely to transition to low marsh. And under 6 feet by 2100, all marshes are projected to drown. And we included this extra 2100 scenario for the late century to be better aligned with other regional efforts. And we did run a number of additional scenarios in addition to these to test the influence of starting elevation sediment supply and found that these results were minimally sensitive to different scenarios. Next slide. So tidal wetland connections to upland areas are key for improving their ability to keep pace with sea level rise. In the Delta, current wetlands are severely limited in their ability to transition to upland areas, specifically in the central Delta, where tidal wetlands are really concentrated. This map shows that extensive potential for upland transition, shown here as the light green color, exists in the region, but that current wetlands, shown in the light blue, don't have adequate connection to migrate upland. Thus, wetland restoration projects for sea level rise will be critical for increasing the resilience of the system. And thankfully, many planned projects show promise in this regard. Next slide. For our analysis of levee ecosystems, we used the probabilistic flood maps that Andrew presented and determined that 53% of them were at risk under the 2050 scenario and 79% were at risk under the 2085 scenario. Notably, if these flooded areas are repaired, so if a levee breach is fixed and an island is pumped out, these ecosystems will likely be relatively resilient to short periods of inundation and be able to persist in the long term. This graph highlights the risk to non-tidal freshwater wetlands in the Delta, which are typically on subsided islands in lower lying areas. And notably, subsidence reversal wetland projects reduce the risk of levee failure, and these will be a key natural adaptation measure for sea level rise moving forward. Next slide. So as I mentioned at the top, changes to temperature and precipitation will also have implications for the Delta's ecosystems, particularly those that depend on seasonal local rainfall like wet meadows, seasonal wetlands, and alkali seasonal wetlands. A detailed assessment of water temperature and its ecosystem implications was out of the scope of this effort, but it is currently being thoroughly assessed by an interagency ecological program project work team. Preliminary analysis shows that increased drought, higher water temperatures, and less frequent floodplain inundation will negatively impact aquatic ecosystems. And we'll be drawing on the work of the project work team to inform the adaptation strategy. So with that, I will hand it back to Harriet to finish.
Yeah, thanks, Dylan. So just wanted to quickly highlight the significance of Delta DAPS. Obviously, a lot of work has already been done in the field of climate change and in the Delta, but this is really the first comprehensive climate change study for this area. We also developed comprehensive flood and water supply models that Andrew talked about that can evaluate a wide range of conditions and are flexible to new information. So as regulations change, as new information comes out, we're able to put that back in the model and rerun it. Also, Delta DAPS developed the socially vulnerable index, as I talked about. And as you know, and that's significant in that that's our first step in really identifying those geographic areas in the Delta as socially vulnerable communities. And this really allows us to focus where adaptation should occur and equitably. Also, we've done, as I mentioned, an extensive community engagement process, really establishing partnerships with those community-based organizations to structure our future outreach efforts to include vulnerable communities. So that's also been very significant for the council. And lastly, we have worked collaboratively with our agency partners in developing our methodology, sharing data so we're consistent, and really verifying our results. And perhaps most importantly, to be complementary in our climate studies. Next slide, please. So the next steps, as I mentioned, the vulnerability assessment's out for public review. We welcome your comments. The last day to submit them is March 16th, and we have the information on the screen there on where to send your comments. And we're currently looking at working on the adaptation strategy and scoping that effort. And next slide. And so with that, that concludes our presentation. I left a few questions up there for discussion, and we're welcome to, we're happy to answer any questions you may have on what we presented today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bob. Can you hear me?
Thanks. This is Anthony from ATP. Yes, Mr. Brandt, we can hear you right now. Thank you so much.
Well, I want to thank all of you for the great presentation, and it was very clear and a lot of content in there, as there is in the report itself, and as you can see for the infographics, and they are really robust and informative. And we have about 20 minutes for questions and discussion. I'm going to start one off, and I hope it's not too challenging, but it's a question that we always get, we the board always get in our reviews, is that this looks like a very informative report. Does it have any recommendations in it? Are there any, is it intended to trigger any actions by anyone? And if so, who?
It does not have any recommendations in there. It's simply a vulnerability assessment at this point. And we do hope that it triggers action amongst all of the agencies and folks that this and the Delta communities that this impacts. But really, for the next phase of the project, adaptation is where we'll be continuing on engagement at all levels of government, as well as with the Delta communities and the various stakeholders, to hopefully come up with those recommendations on the next steps and actions. We also have been, as I mentioned, doing these briefings, these multiple number of briefings, to really get the word out there so that the local governments and others can use our document, the information in the document. And how they use it, will be up to them, of course, but we are doing our best to get the word out there.
Thanks. Any board members have any questions? I see Jim's hand, and then Joe, and then Bob.
Terrific presentations. I've got two questions. The first is the scenarios that you've developed, and you've obviously put a lot of thought and effort into these. Are they available numerically online for other people to use? And the second question is, have you or do you know of anybody else who's using your scenarios of altered hydrology and water temperature to project future scenarios of harmful algal blooms in the Delta?
Andrew, do you want to go ahead and take that one?
Sure. So we have plans. All of it is basically on a GitHub site right now. And we do have plans to kind of put all of that out. We're still kind of in the process of organizing it and getting it together and making sure there's adequate documentation for that. But I think we've certainly made it available to certain folks who've asked for specific pieces or data already. So if you're interested in something specific, please reach out to me after, maybe offline, and we can talk about getting you whatever you need. We did not, just on the temperature piece, we didn't connect air temperature and water temperature at all. We didn't do any modeling to connect those two pieces. So we don't have projections of water temperature. We do have air temperature that went into the water supply modeling that could be connected potentially with the flow data, with another model to kind of connect those up.
Yeah, and Jim, with regards to the question about harmful algal blooms and temperature, that I can't remember off the top of my head if HABs are a particular emphasis of the IEP project work team that's looking at climate change, but I know that water temperature is certainly something that they are looking at. So that's, you know, kind of one of these complementary sister efforts, if you will, in the system. And I know that they're, they will be making some products available. I'm not exactly sure about the timeline, but they're looking at that.
Dylan, what's the name of that IEP work team? What's it called?
Just the Climate Change Project Work Team. And Annika Keeley, who is the co-lead of this, the ecosystem effort with me, is on that and is doing some of the modeling and organization work for that. So I'd be happy to, you know, connect you to for, she can definitely answer more detailed questions than I can about that particular effort.
Good, thanks.
Yep. Hey, Joe?
Yeah, so thank you very much for a very nice, quite comprehensive. And what caught my ear is that you mentioned that you were working with stakeholders in ground rooting the data. But as you know, there's a lot of modeling output come up, especially with climate change, and the data is the problem. And looking at comparing so that you can put some error margins. Can you explain how this was done and kind of context?
Yeah, and perhaps I can start and then defer to Andrew for the details. We did spend a lot of time working with those on the ground stakeholders to ground truth the data, and through that process, and that's really, I would say, probably the latter from spring to fall of last year, especially over the summer, we did make changes to our modeling assumptions and our existing data to be consistent with other data out there. So I think there were really no surprises in some of the data where there were differences. I think it was to be expected from what I understand. But we did spend time working with those folks to make sure our data was consistent and make changes where it was necessary. And we worked with the levee engineers, the flood control agencies, the local agencies themselves. So we went through a pretty extensive process. Andrew, is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just say that we spent a lot of time with the Delta levee engineers making sure our levee elevation data was correct. And then we sync that up, and then we made flood maps to show where we were seeing flooding, and we, under current conditions and under like a 100-year event or a 50-year event, and like looked at that with the levee engineers and said, does this make sense to you? Because we could actually highlight this segment of the levee where we were actually seeing the overtopping occur. And they would say, yeah, that's actually a low point. We know about that. That actually sounds reasonable. Or no, that's not a spot where we've had problems before. And then so we could kind of look at that and look at the water levels. But I would say that we didn't go out to, you know, the lay public to verify our climate data or our flow data. Obviously, that was more of an agency review with other experts in the field. And we, you know, for the flood data we looked at, we worked with the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan folks, SAFCA and SAJAFCA and the Army Corps of Engineers and those folks who work with this kind of data all the time. And we still, you know, disagree with some of them about what the climate change projections say. And we're not probably going to agree, and nobody can say who's right at this point. So we're going to, you know, we feel like we're justified in using what we're using. It's consistent with other state documents. And we've made some notations, especially in the San Joaquin area, in our maps to kind of highlight a few places where there are kind of discrepancies over those flows to kind of walk that out, let people know that, you know, you might want to look at multiple data sources in this area because it's contentious.
And do you have any kind of uncertainty, you know, at least a rough uncertainty?
We didn't explicitly put like uncertainty bounds or a confidence interval on our projections. Instead, we're using, you know, kind of these, this probabilistic approach to say, this is the, you know, the 200 year water level across 2 million, the 2 million scenarios that we ran, this is the 0.5 percentile, essentially, you know, this is the 1 percentile. And so it's not as explicit as you maybe might hope, but I think it does provide enough, it's a comprehensive look at the different uncertainty inputs to the model that you get a range.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, I've got Bob, then Tom, then Diane.
Can you hear me, Steve?
Yes.
Great. All right. Thank you. That was a great presentation, very comprehensive, and I appreciated it. I have a question. It's more out of curiosity. The report is out for public comment. It seems like you're in the pretty much towards the end of it now. I'm very curious about what are some of the common issues that are coming up in terms of the comments that you're receiving back. What are people concerned about, and are there things or are there issues in those comments that have surprised you or made you or making you start to think differently about what your final report might contain? Anyway, I'd like to just hear a few words on that.
Yeah, I can speak to that. So we've actually have only received one formal comment, and it was largely positive from USGS. So we really haven't received any other comments on the vulnerability assessment itself. But I can share with you, as I mentioned, we had a public workshop based focused in the Stockton area last week. And this was put on by the council with the, we partnered with four community-based organizations, and we had the youth present actually their reflections upon the findings of the vulnerability assessment. And so some of those comments were, I don't think any of it was too surprising, but they found the vulnerability assessment difficult, you know, parts of it were difficult to understand because it's more of a technical document, though, you know, we really did try our best to simplify it as much as we could, you know, starting from the technical memos, then going to the vulnerability assessment. So that was a comment, you know, a little bit too technical, want it to be more simplified, want more graphics to illustrate our points. And maybe some potential reorganization of the way we presented the findings. We were asked to perhaps consider putting the findings by location so that, you know, if you're interested in a particular location and how your community is affected by climate change, you know, they can go to one spot and see them all. Right now it's organized by assets, by asset types. Sorry, go ahead.
It sounds like there's nothing serious that's really emerged. I wondered, is in preparing your analyses, did you consider changes in population demographics? You know, looking forward, and you know what that might bring in terms of what eventually you may recommend.
Right, we did not. We looked at existing, so all the numbers for population and so forth and demographics and consideration and the social vulnerability index are all based on existing, what is there today. We don't consider future projects or land use changes or in demographics.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Tom.
All righty. My question has to do with sort of the next step, the adaptation. One of the challenges we have with climate change is that it's not coming to an end in the foreseeable future. It just seems pretty unlikely. And while it's useful to do vulnerability assessments that show the progression as you did from 2030 to 2050, and I can't remember if it was 2080 or 2100, nothing magical happens at that last state. It just keeps on going. And if we're to have an adaptation strategy, it leaves policymakers with the impression that if they address to that last date that we've studied, that we've solved the problem, when in fact it's probably just the beginning of the problem. Have you given much thought to some very long-term, I realize that's very challenging, but some long-term look at where the Delta is headed?
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, first of all, the adaptation strategy we create is not the last that we prepare. It'll be likely something that we're going to have to go back and modify. I cringe as I say that, since we haven't even really begun. But, you know, so that's one thing. It's going to be a dynamic plan or strategy that we'll have to go back and update as conditions continue to change. And we talked a little bit about perhaps identifying a set of strategies for the short term and a set of strategies for the long term. And the long term is going to be likely less detailed and more of an of a vision, objectives, outcome based. Because it'll be difficult to identify those details out to 2100. I mean, that's not really feasible, right? So it's going to be, I would imagine, less detail and more outcome based at that level. But we'll be more focusing on the short term, probably mid-century. We haven't quite gotten there as well in our discussions, but that's what we've talked about internally so far.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're thinking about it, because I think that's really a critical aspect going forward.
One of the things, I don't want to talk too far out of turn here, because as Harriet says, we're really in the early stages of kind of scoping this thing out. But one of the things that we've been thinking about a little bit is, you know, when you think about like levee improvements, we can look at the kind of trajectory of water level increase and the cost of increasing the size of levees. And we can kind of look at, hey, what would be the annualized or the decadal investment cost that we would need to commit to keep up with this? And that presumably keeps going and probably grows over time. It's not a, you know, oh, we just need $20 billion now and then we're good. You know, it's fixed. It's not. It's $100 billion or $100 million every whatever so long, you know, every 5 years or 10 years, whatever it is. And that's a little bit more of a long-term kind of thinking of this. This isn't a one-time investment. This is an operational cost.
And I guess I'll just chime in very quickly from an ecosystem perspective to actually maybe take the opposite look that I mentioned in my talk, which is that for the ecosystems, really looking back is just as important as looking forward. And we have so far to go to reclaim even a fraction of the historical ecosystem function and condition in the Delta. We have those two stacked on top of each other. And thankfully, as I mentioned, I do think that restoration presents an opportunity to take things that we're learning about climate change and actually build them in a way that updating existing ecosystems, it would be a lot more challenging for a variety of reasons. So I think both that looking even farther out, and then particularly with the ecosystems, making sure that we're understanding that we're fighting a massive uphill battle here that's evident by any measure of ecological health. So that's really important to keep in mind as we think about the natural communities in the Delta.
Thank you.
So just a time check here. Edmund, do we have any scheduled public comments?
There are none.
Okay, I wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, I was going to now go to Diane and then Jay.
So my comment is almost the opposite of Tom's. You know, when you go out to 2100 and assume that it'll just keep going and going, I may be a Pollyanna here, but I think it would be equally valid to include some transition to carbon negative by 2050, and you know, this idea that we'll just tolerate all of this, I find quite equally extreme. And so I just wanted to put that concern out there. And I also wanted to know about why not consider 2040? Because in a way, that's a timing, that's a nearer term than 2050. So there's quite a gap between 2030 and 2050 in terms of some ongoing projects. Or possible projects such as the Delta Conveyance Project.
Yes, thank you, Diane. So first of all, we just presented our information. We have, obviously the models are so comprehensive. We could give you we can pull out and extract any time frame that you want, any date, any year that you want, and present that information that way. But we just presented, it was easier to just pick mid-century, end of century. So I should just point that out. So the data is available. But yes, we haven't determined exactly what our planning horizon is for adaptation. And maybe 2040 is reasonable, 2030, you know, some range of activities for the short term, and what that exact short term timeframe is, we haven't gotten there yet. But 2040 can definitely be something we look at as well.
That's another, just to add to that, we have some tools that we're working on, a Shiny app that will be available, I think, within a week or two, that allows users to just explore and make maps of the flooding based on the maps that we have, but adding different assets and looking at their specific area. But we've also started to work on another app that would be more geared toward folks like you and other researchers that want to look at things that we didn't look at. So instead of pairing the specific, so you could look at just sea level rise impacts on flooding, or just the flow impacts, and looking at it by different decade. And so we're still working on some tools on that, and we're looking to reach out to researchers that might be interested in those tools and using them in the future. So maybe I'll try and reach out to you and get some more detail on what you're thinking, because I think we could maybe accommodate that. That's something we'd like to serve up.
Thank you.
Hey, Jay.
Yeah. Thank you very much for this great report and very nice presentation. I think this is a marvelous assemblage of all the different ways in which we have climate change vulnerabilities to the Delta and the ecosystems, the economy, and the blah, 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 blah. I have a technical question, though. On the flood analysis, was overtopping the only mechanism for levee failure that you looked at?
Correct.
Most levees don't fail by overtopping. They fail before that. Certainly, that's been the recent experience.
Well,
I'm just saying this because when I look at the maps, it looks like you could safely put Sacramento in the middle of the subsided parts of the Delta. And I don't think anyone would really want to do that. Certainly, in terms of land use planning, those are all considered to be well within the 100-year floodplain. And you have all that area as basically very safe. In the present, which it worries me.
Yeah, part of the reason that many of those areas are showing that they wouldn't flood under a 200-year event in the present is because they have a foot and a half of freeboard over the 100-year event enough.
But you're only assuming overtopping failures.
Correct.
You'll often, very frequently, see the failure before overtopping. It's related to the high water level, of course, but
yes,
it doesn't wait until overtopping in many cases, if not most cases.
No, you're absolutely right. This, if anything, understates the risks that's out there.
Right, and so I worry about this map, particularly in the present, that it might give land developers an awful lot more confidence than they really ought to have. Those places really are vulnerable. We should not be siting houses there.
No,
it makes it seem like it's safer than the pocket area of Sacramento.
Yeah, I see your point. That I just to explain why we didn't include failure below overtopping is because that requires the use of like a fragility curve of some sort. And that is a highly contentious issue in the Delta. We're dealing with that as part of the Delta levy investment strategy right now. And we do address it there.
I feel the assumption of a perfectly reliable levy should also be contentious.
Fair. That's a fair comment.
But I do worry in that, the Delta Protection Commission, might have some problems with this, I would think.
Well,
but thank you. I think, that's
an important
thing for you to address someplace, but you have time.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you. And I think it's a yes or no question. I saw temperature extremes being highlighted. Did you also look at the seasonal onset and duration of summer warming as a factor? The length of the growing season, the length of everything is one of the things that happens with climate change. More than just the extremes. Did you look at that? Does that come into play at all? Or is that data available? Or
I think we looked at it through the literature, existing literature review for agriculture. I am unsure that we did that in the water supply or ecosystem. Not in water supply, and I'm not sure about ecosystems.
No, for precipitation, yes. So timing of precipitation was one of the things that was looked at with, essentially decreases in both fall and spring and potential increases in the winter. But I don't believe that there's a similar temporal analysis for the temperature.
All right. Thank you very much, Edmund. Any public comments on this?
There are none.
Well, I really want to thank you. This has really been a very informative, a very interesting conversation. I do encourage our board members to have a look at that report, and always you're welcome to send in any individual comments, and comments can be in the form of a question if you have remaining questions. And I would guess if there were other questions that board members would think about, we could send them to Edmund and send them off to you guys to get, just get some further insight if we wanted to. So I see heads nodding, so I think that's okay to do. So, well, thank you again. Thank you very much. This is very informative.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, that concludes item number 4. So we're moving on to number 5, and I think we're only 1 or 2 minutes behind schedule. And that's the lead scientist report. And Laurel, are you starting off?
Yes, I'm starting off. I'm just going to speak briefly before I hand the mic back to Cheryl Patel, who you heard from earlier, and she's going to give a report on the Adaptive Management Forum that was last week. But I just wanted to highlight briefly, next slide, please, that we are preparing the next issue of State of Bay Delta Science, the 2022 update, with a theme that's very much in line with the board's focus on harmful algal blooms and also the focus on invasive species in the invasive species review. So the model that we're moving towards with State of Bay Delta Science is to produce more frequent updates than historically that are topically focused along the line of specific themes. This theme is ecosystem services and disservices of Bay Delta primary producers, or in other words, how plants and algae affect ecosystems and respond to management of the estuary and its watershed. I've reported on this before. I just wanted to show you the chapters that are shaping up. At this point, lead authors have been identified and they have submitted preliminary outlines of their chapters. We actually just met about the outlines right before this meeting. But the chapters are going to be Historical Ecology of Primary Production in the San Francisco Estuary, Invasion Processes and Ecosystem Engineering of Invasive Species, Exploring a Way Forward for Management of Invasive Aquatic Macrophytes, Emerging Methods for Studying Primary Producers from Macrophytes to Microalgae. In this chapter really has a focus on remote sensing methods. Cyanobacteria and Harmful Algal Blooms, and then Carbon Sequestration and Subsidence Reversal. So this is a topic that we're quite focused on through the production of this 2022 update. Moving along, oh, I'm hitting the down arrow on my computer. The other thing I wanted to bring to your attention is the Steelhead workshop that is going to occur next week, which might be of interest to ISB members, particularly those of you who are working on the monitoring enterprise review. This would be a really good orientation. So this workshop supports the biological opinion on long-term operation of the Central Valley Plan and State Water Project, which aims to develop a plan to monitor steelhead populations within the San Joaquin Basin and San Joaquin River downstream of the confluence with the Stanislaus River. And this also includes steelhead and rainbow trout on non-project San Joaquin tributaries as well. The agenda is posted on the Delta Stewardship Council webpage, and you could also visit that to register for the meeting, which is free. But the agenda focuses on management challenges, so looking to out-of-basin monitoring experiences so that lessons learned can be extracted that are applicable to this region. Many stakeholders are going to be involved in this discussion. There's going to be a discussion on the monitoring framework, really focused on identifying top priorities for monitoring and assessing what has already been, what is already being monitored. And then the third day is going to focus on analytical approaches. So what does a balanced sampling framework look like given the extreme spatial and temporal variability within this region and the large size of the Sacramento and San Joaquin watersheds? What tools are needed to make regional to make a regional monitoring plan successful? So please do drop into that workshop if you have the opportunity and find it relevant to your ongoing efforts. With that, I'm going to turn the mic over to Cheryl, who will provide a discussion of the adaptive management workshop, which took place last week.
Thanks, Laurel. I'm actually going to be also reporting on this with my colleague, Chelsea Batavia, who was a primary, had a primary role in making the forum possible. So just to get us started here. So the forum happened last week, and this was the second biennial forum that the Delta Science Program hosted. The Delta Science Plan actually calls for regularly convened adaptive management forums. And so the forum is a good venue to communicate different adaptive management approaches and find means to create pathways towards more consistent implementation, which the Science Plan also calls for. This call was echoed by the ISB in their 2016 thematic review of adaptive management in the Delta as well. So the forum last week was meant to bring managers, researchers, planners, and decision makers together to share and synthesize information, communicate best practices and lessons learned, and encourage dialogue around adaptive management. The forum featured six morning sessions across 3 days. Session topics included a history of adaptive management in the Delta, adaptive management planning, closing the adaptive management loop, and the future of adaptive management, among others. In the afternoons, we also hosted interactive workshops on adaptive management planning, permitting, and also the Delta Landscape Scenario Planning Tool. So a key point brought up during the forum, especially in closing plenaries, was the importance of system-level thinking. So moving forward, ecosystem-based management, especially in light of climate change impacts, will require common goals, leadership, and stakeholder engagement. On this topic, a question we visited throughout the forum was how to translate project-level outcomes to landscape-level learning and adaptation. Many folks also mentioned that thoughtful participatory engagement led to positive outcomes on their projects. It was widely noted that early and frequent engagement with stakeholders, including impacted groups and communities, is key. When planning their projects, if stakeholders are included in conversations about alternative outcomes, varying levels of uncertainties, everyone can be on the same page when things don't go according to plan, which can happen, as a few of the talks at the forum highlighted. And now I'd like to invite Chelsea to cover some a few more points.
Cheryl, another important theme that emerged throughout the forum was forward-looking science for an uncertain future in the context of adaptive management. This was a note that was first hit by Chair Susan Jatayan in her welcoming remarks when she cited the ISB's call for forward-looking science. It was picked up again by our Delta lead scientist, Laurel Larson, when she outlined a vision for an iterative process of dialogue between science and governance, supported by monitoring, integrated modeling and forecasting, and culminating in a system where management responds in near real time to environmental change. I would highly recommend watching that presentation if you have time. Another theme under this umbrella is how to handle uncertainty. And the forum highlighted how various people are navigating restoration in the Delta against a backdrop of uncertainty. We heard about several tools that are being used effectively in the Delta to plan in the face of uncertainty, including structured decision-making to help support, to help set priorities among multiple objectives given resource constraints and key uncertainties. We heard about the use of quantitative and conceptual models to predict outcomes and highlight important uncertainties. And we heard about the use of pilot studies to test effects of revegetation or devegetation at a small scale before implementing work at a full project scale. And those are just a few of the tools that we were exposed to at the forum. Another important tool that is useful for planning in the face of an uncertain future is the Delta Landscapes Scenario Planning Tool. This is an online map-based tool developed by the San Francisco Estuary Institute with the support of the Delta Stewardship Council. And it allows for comparison of land use scenarios across a range of ecological and economic outcomes, such as fish habitat, agriculture, and inundation. The tool output provides science-based quantified assessment of impacts of restoration work at both the project and landscape scale, allowing for more holistic thinking and planning. Two afternoon workshops at the forum provided an overview of the tool. Those video recordings can be made available if you're interested to learn more. SFEI will also be presenting on the tool at the Delta Stewardship Council meeting on February 25th with more information about the tool's applications and planned updates over the next year and a half. An additional theme that we heard throughout the forum is adaptive management challenges. And in the past, the limitations of funding have been widely recognized, but the forum also surfaced some other key constraints that are related more closely to institutional arrangements. What we heard is that it's difficult to find the flexibility to adapt, and this can be impeded by things such as permits, regulations, and administrative processes. And that, with that, I will hand it back to Cheryl. Thank you.
Thanks, Chelsea. Just to round out here, the forum is, you know, is meant as a resource for people who practice adaptive management. And I wanted to mention another major resource for folks is the Interagency Adaptive Management Integration Team. They're a technical advisory group that's made up of local, state, and federal scientific and technical staff. And they offer input and guidance on adaptive management in the Delta at a level that helps to cross-cut individual agency missions. So in this group's effort to help adaptive management planning be more consistent and efficient, the group's website hosts a library of resources for planning and implementing adaptive management for anyone to use. Lastly, I think, as Chelsea mentioned, the forum sessions are all recorded and will be available to everyone soon. If ISB members are interested in learning about restoration projects in the Delta and their approaches to adaptive management, we especially recommend the two lightning talk sessions during the forum. And thank you, and we'll take any questions you may have.
Thanks very much. Edmund, can you make sure that we get a copy of the URL when those videos are available?
Yeah, we'll make sure to include that in your meeting package.
And will there be any kind of formal written report from the forum?
There will be, yes. That's something we're going to be working on in upcoming months.
Okay. Any questions from the board on anything presented by the lead scientist? Okay, I don't see any hands up. Well, thank you very much. Any public comments on this? Edmund?
There are none.
Okay, let's move on to the next item, which is item six on the agenda, the talking about our status and where we're going with the science needs assessment and our presentation to DPIC. And I'll turn the mic over to Jay.
So what you should have before you is a two-page summary of what we're thinking of taking to DPIC in a couple of weeks, which basically is a very short summary of where we think we are with the science needs assessment, which is not completed yet, not as far along as I'd hoped, but I think we've made some very substantial progress. And it basically summarizes the idea of the main theme for the science needs assessment will be on interagency forecasting in applied to a number of different areas, but to use that as a uniting principle for a science needs assessment. The principal objectives, I think, of our presentation to DPIC are to, first of all, remind the DPIC committee, the agency heads, that this effort is ongoing and that we've had quite a few discussions and that we are pretty solid on recommending this as a principal theme and get them to be interested in that and understand it. And then we also have a request that they submit people to be members of a technical forecasting task force so that we, as we continue on in the science needs assessment, we'll have really direct input from the technical people in the agencies that are most familiar with what is going on within the agencies and how the agencies are thinking about forecasting. So that as we develop all the technical and governance kinds of recommendations for this, we will hopefully be able to do that with the information and understanding and wisdom, hopefully, of people that are actually involved in this within the diverse agencies that this would have to span. Steve, do you have anything to add to that?
No, just that the board meeting is on March 15th, and we'll make that presentation. And then I believe there's the DPIC meeting, I'm sorry, is March 15th. And the next one, I think, is scheduled for sometime in July. And by then, we hope to have the final report prepared, and input from the task force would also help us to hone that report to make sure it's relevant as it can be to the agencies.
This seemed like an important opportunity for us to get some mid-course correction from them if we're really going off in the wrong direction, but also hopefully start to build some support for the general kinds of recommendations that we're likely to have.
So I guess
you looking for comments?
Yes.
I just had one big comment. I'll also send you some more detailed comments. First of all, I really like this focus. I think it makes a lot of sense. I think I've mentioned before, it's worked really well in my region to focus what science is really needed to support decision-making. So sounds great. But I do wonder why there's no explicit reference to testing alternative management options as opposed to just a more generic forecasting. I think it would be good to bring that out specifically. And I did give you some more specific examples in a draft I'll send you. But I wanted to explain to you why I added that.
That's a nice idea.
Yeah, that's great, because this will be the two-page document, but I think for us to try and make it relevant in our presentation, we really want to have examples and what does this really mean and how does it work. And so that kind of input is really valuable. Any other comments or thoughts? Or I don't see any hands up. You're certainly welcome to provide those individually once you had a time to look at this and send them to us, and then you'll have another opportunity to look at the next. I know you've all had a chance individually to comment on a previous draft of the report itself, and you'll have that opportunity again before it gets finalized. Anything else, Jay?
No, I think that's great. It's important, I think, for the board to follow along with this and give us, useful improvements.
We always interpret silence as a resounding endorsement. So just so you know that. So
yeah, we're gonna put everybody's name that's silent. We're gonna put them on first, authors.
Edmund, any public comment?
There are none.
All right. We'll then move on to the update on the water supply reliability review. And Jay, that's yours too.
Yeah. So, this report, which hopefully you've had some chance to look over and maybe make some comments on, is something that several of us have been tinkering on for some time. This is the first time you have seen it, and I think before we develop a public draft, I think it's really important to have people on the board be fairly comfortable with it. Not comfortable as a final document, but comfortable as a, oh, this is ready for public comment, or close to ready for public comment. I have some areas that I'd like to see improvements on it as well. Any initial thoughts? Is this ready for prime time, or you can send us scorching emails or whatever on detailed comments if you'd like? In class, this usually means nobody's read the assignment.
Jay, do you have a deadline of when you'd like to get some input on this individually?
Yes. I would like any comments on this within the next week or so, week or two. If you haven't looked at it yet, if you've got comments, please send them in, and we'll after you've looked at it, the bottom line at this point in the process is what changes do you think we really ought to address that aren't in there before it becomes public? Or do you think it's ready for a more public discussion?
So in that case, you would revise it, or your team would revise it, and then send it back to the board as a whole, and then discuss it.
Yeah, if we get feedback from everyone that's resounding, oh yeah, this is great, it's ready for public discussion, then the next version that the board sees could be a public review draft, essentially. But if the board wants to see another iteration or two of it before it becomes a public review draft, I think that's perfectly reasonable. Joe, Tom, you've also worked on this. Anything to add?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I know it's a little difficult topic, except for Jay. So I think if you can give us whatever the high-level opinions about how to improve the readability and kind of make it to a normal level, that will be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, and I would just second what Joe is saying, that I've reread this thing so many times now that I've started to get comfortable with it. But when I step back from it, I realize it's a pretty intimidating document. And yeah, just hearing you say that would be helpful, and how we might, if that is indeed the case, how we might frame our message.
Okay, Jay, do you have what you need?
Well, I'm hopefully we'll get some emails that have what we need. Please let us know if you think this needs improvement, or maybe you think it's just so bad we should just cancel this whole review. Just look, that would be merciful. So if you feel that way, just let me know.
But Jay, you cannot do that, because we have spent so much time on this now.
Yeah, and I said that. I'm not worried.
It might help me get tenure.
Well, I think Joe and Tom's comments are really, take those to heart, because it's, you got to think about who the intended audience is of these reviews, and our number one audience is the council, and then the broader audiences that we talk about. And if you read a paragraph and it's just incomprehensible, and like, I'm a fish guy, and I'm sure it all is, but it's okay to highlight it and say, what the heck are you talking about?
Right.
And that's perfectly a very, very solid and valuable comment to get.
The purpose of it to me is, it's for the science and science managers throughout the system that are working in this area, but it's also got to communicate effectively to the science managers and the sort of deputy director level people that want to know something about this field. Right?
Okay, Edmund, any public comment on this?
There are none.
Okay, we'll move on to item number 8, I believe, which is the preparation for upcoming Delta meetings. And this one is going to maybe take us a little bit longer than it normally does. What we had laid out is a series of 2 meetings per month, and the general intent was to have our first meeting of the month be sort of the detailed, this kind of meeting. We talk about all of our reviews, get information items. Oops. Okay, and get information items and things like that, and have the second meeting of the month be focused more on a bigger sort of exploratory topic, and we had decided to go with a sort of future thinking with a HABS focus. So our next meeting is scheduled for February 23rd, and I know that there are 2 groups we haven't heard from. One is the call it a gaggle rather than a team, but the folks dealing with the monitoring enterprise, and I know they've had a meeting, and also the ones dealing with HABS. And I guess I would like, you know, just a minute or so update on those 2 groups and see where they are in terms of our future meetings. And I guess the thing I'd put on the table is to ask the question, are we ready to have a HABS discussion in on February 23rd, or we could cancel that meeting and move it to either our, as part of our next meeting in March 3rd, or to get a discussion of where we're at and where we want to go, and are we ready to dive into something? So let me first go to Joe and get a little bit of a status on monitoring, and then to Jim, a status on the HAB thing in that context. You're on mute, Joe. You're on mute. Joe?
So we have a new writing team, as you all know, for monitoring enterprise review. So that includes Diane McKnight and Tanya Heitler and myself and a few staff members. So we had our first meeting on last Monday, which is the, I think, 8th of February. So we discussed quite in depth what to do. As some of you know, that the next step of this monitoring review was the interviews, which was supposed to be held last summer. But due to extenuating circumstances, we had to move to this year. So now I think we are slowly getting ready to move on. So we discussed a few things. First of all, that we really should get first look at the draft we have. John Weens and Vince Resch, they put together an initial draft on this, and it's available. But the draft has holes here and there. They're asking us to put, you know, stuff here and there. And Steve was in the committee too. And so we basically had a quick look on the existing review and then decided that it needs a certain amount of rewriting. The skeleton is quite good, that we have to fill up the holes at various places. Readability can be quite improved. And also the content-wise, what extra content should come in? So one of the things we discussed was that we will have the in-person, or in this case, Zoom interviews. And then whatever the input we get from that also, we will merge and fill up and revise this existing document. So when will be the interviews? So we discussed that also. We kind of merged on to after 15th of March. The reason is that the staff, we need the help of staff, and Chelsea and the crowd, they are quite busy with other stuff till 15th of March. So we will have the interviews thereafter. So around 1st of March, they will start contacting. There's a list of about 22 people we have contacted. Not contacted. We will be contacting. The current questionnaire has about 12 questions. I don't know whether you had a look at it. that questionnaire was developed assuming that this is for people who did not send the written questionnaire. So Tanya graciously agreed to look at these questions and also look at the responses we got from the mail-in questionnaire, and then kind of upgrade the questionnaire we have so that it's kind of a much more informative. So that's our plan. And then once you do that, I think we will get input from the committee, the whole board, and then we will go ahead with the interviews. I think Chelsea and Tanya both have contacted, I think Jess, her name is Jess, I think, Rudnick, the social new social scientist. Sorry, I haven't met her yet. And she will help us out also. Chelsea will be the person who will be kind of helping us with the interviews and protocols and analysis. And already the written questionnaire has been analyzed by Cheryl. So those data are available at least this called the Likert. The scale analysis has been done. So that is available. So we will basically move forward with the interviews, and then we will come up with a plan how to go ahead with writing. So I don't know whether I forgot anything to mention, Tanya and Diane, anything to add?
Well, I wanted to add that some editing of this report could be done now, you know, concurrently, potentially with the interviews, more of a kind of technical editing where there's some of the recommendations, there's 17, some of them aren't really recommendations, they're more context or things we can't do anything about, so that needs to go somewhere else. So, you know, I don't know, because if the report were, that aspect of it were further along, it might be easier to integrate whatever comes out of the interviews when that happens. So that's just a comment that there could be some work done on editing, not necessarily by a writing team, but maybe by, you know, getting it into better shape to then improve.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think that covers it, Joe, Diane.
It's covered. So, and Cheryl, probably can you let us know what's the status? You have done the initial Likert analysis, Likert scale analysis. Then they have some responses, written responses. Are you in the process, or can you give a quick overview of that?
Yeah, so all of the Likert scale responses have been analyzed and put into summary graphics. But the written responses, I still need to go through them and kind of group them into what I call like themes. So that work I still need to get done, but I can prioritize that so that it's ready for you before you start these interviews, so that it provides a little context if possible.
Oh, that will be appreciated. So I think that's all we have. Thank you very much. Thank you, Cheryl, and Tanya and Diane.
Thanks, Joe. So we currently have you on the agenda for the March 3rd meeting. And it does seem like a good opportunity to get, you know, Cheryl's analysis and maybe have a look at the questions and list of interviewees to get some input from the whole board, and maybe even get a status report on what analyses have been done on the inventory analyses. That I know Cheryl's done a few questions like that, but what's been done, and we get some input from the full board as to is there anything that might be worth pursuing. All right, so good. We have you down for the March 3rd then for that. Jim, want a status and thoughts on future meetings?
Let me talk a little bit about the HAB subgroup. Diane and Lisa and Virginia and I met a couple of days ago, and this was our first meeting as a group. And so our assignment is to do something forward-looking with HAB, and that's about as broad an assignment as you can get. So we just had a brainstorming session, and I started with an idea, And the idea is grounded in the notion that if we're going to look forward into the dynamics of HABs and the Delta, it probably would be useful to have a starting place of where we are right now. So I propose the idea of bringing in a series of people, perhaps on a monthly basis, to give a presentation on a particular aspect of the HAB challenge, have a discussion. And the idea would be, we would be building toward an assessment of what do we know, what do we not know, what do we need to know, what is the potential for using models to project changes in the status of HABs in the Delta. And within about 8 minutes of the discussion, that idea was cast aside. And it was cast aside for a couple of reasons. One was the members of this subgroup are enthusiastic about the possibility of having a postdoc work on this problem. And they thought that if that was going to happen, it would make sense for the postdoc to be engaged in the assessment development. Another reason is that you know, this is a substantial job. To do this assessment is a substantial job, and we would need help to do that. But I think the most important reason that this idea was cast aside is both Lisa and Virginia thought that instead of bringing in a bunch of scientists to talk about science, it would be more useful for us to start engaging the policymakers and regulators right off the bat. And they made a pretty compelling case. And so that's kind of where we are. So we have, we assigned ourselves two tasks. I reached out to, we need to start building a list of agencies and staff members who are responsible for setting policies and regulations to protect the Delta from harmful algal blooms and other water quality problems. So I reached out to Edmund. Of course, he was helpful right off the bat. So I'm going to take the lead in compiling a list of potential stakeholders who should engage. And then Lisa and Virginia talked about the idea of a charrette. And I'd like them to talk about just a little bit about what they have in mind so that you all and I have a better sense of how they'd like to proceed. And then the last thing that I want to say is that on the 23rd of February, I don't think we're going to have anything prepared to deliver, but I learned from Edmund yesterday that, and we heard this from Laurel again today, that Rafe Cudella at UC Santa Cruz has taken the lead in the chapter on HABs in the upcoming 2022 State of Beta Delta Science. And Rafe was on my list of people to invite. I think if there's one person that we want to listen to about HABs in the Delta, it's Rafe Cudella. So one possibility, and I'm just want to get your feedback on this, is I could reach out to Rafe and see if a miracle happens and he's available at 4 o'clock on the 23rd of February. The odds are small, but if you can, I mean, we could use that meeting to listen to Rafe and have a discussion. If not, then I don't think we're going to be prepared to do anything unless Lisa and Virginia wanted to use that time to kind of walk through what a charrette would look like, how would it be structured, who would be there, what would be the product. So that's kind of where we are. So I'd like your thoughts on, should I reach out to Ray for the 23rd of February? And then I'd like to hear from Lisa and Virginia about, you know, their concept of how we should proceed in the next months.
It sounds to me like it's, we do have the time scheduled. It was scheduled and devoted towards HABs, and it seems like what you're saying is that if you can get Rafe to do it on that date, either the first or second hour, I know they have to have a decision on that, I think by tomorrow or something like that, although we can give a general announcement. And it looks like if it's a no, then we cancel the meeting. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes.
And then what we could do in that case is to then schedule you for March 3rd, give you some time on the March 3rd meeting, and discuss the ideas for a way forward that you guys would like to talk about or chat or let us know.
So I'd like Lisa and Virginia to respond to that.
Yeah, that sounds great. I mean, I sent you an email, Jim, that you may not have had a chance to look at yet, but I think that's a great plan. To your larger question of what, first of all, I'd like to recharacterize a little bit of what you just said. We all really liked your idea, and we really just didn't want to proceed without the postdoc. And the main additions we had were that we bring in modelers to help us understand what to do with all the details we were learning, to kind of package it up a bit was what we were thinking. But then we also realized what a huge job it was, and we wanted to potentially narrow our focus. And now that we know about this other work going on, I think that's even more important to just stay out of the lanes of people who are already doing some of this work. So that's why Rafe would be great, because he is leading this effort, and then perhaps he might have suggestions of what would complement that effort. So that makes perfect sense to me. As for the charrette, and I see Virginia's unmuted, so we'll give her a chance here too. We started talking about a conceptual model of just really understanding, you know, for whatever problem we were trying to address, what pieces were absolutely necessary or most important. And, you know, I think we're both, Virginia and I have known each other a little while, I think we're both pretty visual thinkers in terms of wanting to sort of sketch out, you know, who the players are in terms of what actions can be taken, what are the science connections and feedbacks we need to include, and then think about, you know, how does that play out in terms of how we can contribute. So that's what I was thinking. And Virginia and I haven't had a chance to meet on this. Go ahead, Virginia.
Well, first I want to say I totally agree. We took Jim's idea and morphed it. We did not throw it out. I see this as an assessment and a path toward getting toward his ideas. So we all agree with each other, of course. And Lisa and I are going to meet to talk about how to do the charrette. And we haven't done that before, but when I've done it in the past, it's really useful to have a very open give and take with the stakeholders of us as scientists presenting our ideas and having them talk to us about what their concerns are. And we wanted to think toward the end of where this would go, so that when we do produce this product, I'll just call it that for now, it really meets the stakeholder needs, so we don't start down a path without being aware of where they're going. And a charrette is just an open-ended process for doing that. It might be useful to talk about this as we move ahead, because I see that this group really wants to engage the stakeholders more, and this is a process that is useful at the beginning in an open-ended way to learn.
I just wanted to also support this approach. I wasn't able to stay for the full meeting of this group. And I also see that one area where we haven't had an expert give us information is in the area of drinking water quality and what's known about these toxins. And if Ray isn't able to join the meeting on later this month, there may be a short update about what the issues are in terms of drinking water quality might be useful for our group going forward, because we didn't address that specifically in the previous session we had on HABs.
Edmund.
If I may, can I provide a staff recommendation, Steve?
Sure.
Yeah, so I think February 3rd is rapidly coming up, and we are releasing a notice tomorrow. So I just think it may, we can totally release something and say there will be a presenter to talk about harmful algal blooms. But I just think from a publicity standpoint, in terms of outreach and all of that, it'll be logistically difficult, especially since the scope of this project is still evolving. So I would like to propose that maybe having this invited speaker, maybe March 18th would be more ideal. It gives them more time to plan and to reach out to presenters rather than trying to find a backup speaker on the 23rd to make happen, which is only like less than 2 weeks away. But the decision is ultimately up to the board on how you want to decide on what you want to do in your 23rd meeting. I think the original idea was to kind of elaborate a little more on the proposal, and we're kind of having this discussion today during the preparation of upcoming meetings. So that's just the staff recommendation that maybe the March 18th for the invited speaker may give some more time to plan out exactly what we want out of that presentation.
You're such a wise guy, Edmund.
And I'll make one modification to that. It could also be March 3rd. We can readjust our schedule a bit to fit the speaker in March 3rd. So maybe if you invite the speaker, Jim, that either date would work for us, I think. We have a full schedule on the 3rd, but we can readjust it and fit him in on the 3rd.
Okay, so I'll reach out to Rafe when we hang up here and give him those two options, and I'll let you all know what he says.
That's fantastic. So we will, for the March 3rd, we will wait for that word to see about the details of it. We have scheduled a variety of our typical things on needs assessment and so forth. I mean, our reviews and so forth. But fitting that in would be appropriate, or we'll do it on the 18th. And we will cancel the 23rd meeting then without objection. But all of you have slotted that time space, so it might be a time if you have small group meetings to take advantage of it. You don't have to do another doodle poll. Does that seem reasonable? Okay, I see nodding heads and a thumbs up. So let's do that and cancel the 23rd. We'll have our meeting.
Steve, I just want to make sure I have the time right for the 18th of March. I have 10 to 12 on the 18th of March. Is that right? Or Edmund?
Yes, 10 to 12 Pacific time.
And then March 3rd.
March 3rd, it's 10:30 to 12:30 Pacific time.
Oh, why does my calendar say the 4th of March? Is it really the 3rd?
Yes.
Ooh.
There was a rescheduling of a date that we sent out a few weeks ago, but we can confirm logistics on that offline if there are issues.
And what time does the March 3rd meeting? What time does that start?
10:30.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 10:30 to 12:30 is what it's scheduled. So okay. It may not need the full hour. So.
Okay, I'll reach out.
We'll need the 2 hours. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll reach out to Rafe right away and let you know what he says.
Sounds good.
In terms of drinking water quality, I agree with Diane. I think this is something that we need to dive into a little bit as well. And one person I think would be really good is Deanna Serrano at Contra Costa Water, but maybe there are others as well. Jay, do you?
Yeah, she'd be a good contact person because both Contra Costa and Metropolitan, both of them, I'm sure, will have some very good people that pay attention to this issue.
So could Edmund help us find a speaker for that topic? And a date?
Yes, that's something we can help with. And just to clarify, Jim, you were thinking about like separate seminar presentations, right? Not like a joint seminar panel?
That's right.
Okay, so individual seminar presentation.
Right.
In addition, Santa Clara Valley will have probably have some treatment people that are very interested in this as well. So I think among all of those groups, you should be able to find one articulate expert.
Jay, could you just give us the really quick answer to the question of where are the municipal drinking water intakes in the Delta? I don't know where they are.
Certainly the Clifton Court Forbay. For the State Water Project.
Okay.
You might even be drinking water from there yourself, actually.
Stockton?
Stockton they have an intake on the eastern side of the Delta. The Contra Costa intake.
Where is that?
It's just a little bit north of the of Clifton Court Forbay on Middle River. Okay. They have several intakes, but that's the main one.
Right. I just know Deanna is terrific. She is so knowledgeable. She would be a really good speaker.
But she's more of a hydrodynamics and Delta modeling person rather than what are the health impacts and what does that mean for the treatment plant operations?
That's right.
Yeah, if I could suggest a way forward, maybe is that I know Edmund and staff have worked on already compiling a small list of folks with their areas of expertise, and they, I'm sure, would be happy to do that with guidance from that group, and then go out to board members and see if they have others, and then kind of sift out a plan of how you might want to move forward, and then they could present that to the board or at our March 3rd meeting.
I wanted to say there's really that the drinking water issues are different from the recreational and public exposure. Those are two different areas where there's a lot of uncertainty about the consequences of low level exposure of these toxins that are in the produced water from the drinking water treatment facilities. And I think bringing that forward to the board is an important step.
Metropolitan has some pretty sophisticated water chemists that look at a lot of these things. So I think either they or someone that they would suggest would probably be excellent for this.
Rafe could also speak to this. It's not his area of expertise, but he's pretty knowledgeable across all these different domains of HAB-related problems.
Okay, any other thoughts on the scheduling in particular? Edmund, any public comment on this?
There are none.
Okay, I'm going to skip item number 9, which is a report out on action items, and because Edmund's doing such a great job at as sending those in writing to us, and then move on to item 10, which is any public comments for matters not on the agenda?
There are none.
All right, any other thoughts from people before we adjourn?
Please read the water supply reliability report, since we don't have that meeting in February, end of February. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks everyone. Stay safe, and meeting is adjourned with 3 minutes to spare.